In Matthew chapter 12, we're told about a time when Jesus was at a synagogue on the Sabbath day, and there was a man there who had a withered hand. And some of the Pharisees who were there confronted Jesus and asked him a question. "Is it lawful," they asked, "to heal on the Sabbath?" Of course, Jesus knew what they were doing, because this wasn't the first time they'd confronted him about the Sabbath. Jesus knew that they disapproved of really anyone doing any action that may seem like work on the Sabbath. And he knew that they were trying to trap him into admitting that he didn't take the Sabbath that seriously. But instead of answering, Jesus posed his own question to them. "Which one of you who has a sheep, if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not take hold of it and lift it out?" Now, you might think that what Jesus is doing here is he's turning the tables on the Pharisees, and he's pointing out that really everybody makes exceptions on the Sabbath for something. I mean, nobody's just going to leave their animal in a ditch. No one takes the Sabbath laws that seriously. At least that's one way to understand Jesus' question, but that's not really what he's getting at. Jesus isn't suggesting that other things are more important than Sabbath restrictions, and everybody has exceptions sometimes. He's actually trying to help the Pharisees better understand the Sabbath law and its purpose. If you read Deuteronomy chapter 5, where the Sabbath command is given, you may notice two things. First, it's the longest commandment of the Ten Commandments. Moses devotes more words to articulating and explaining the fourth commandment than any other. Second, you also may notice that the commandment about the Sabbath and how it applies is really very wide. Moses doesn't just tell the Israelites that they are to rest on the seventh day. He says that they are to ensure that everyone else, their sons, their daughters, their male and female servants, the foreigners living among them, even their livestock, all are to cease from working on the Sabbath day. In other words, the intent of the fourth commandment is not simply to keep people from working. It is to invite them into a lifestyle of bringing rest and bringing relief to the lives of others, which is why Jesus uses that example with the Pharisees. His point isn't that they care more about their sheep than about the Sabbath. His point is that if they really understood the Sabbath law, then they would rescue that animal so that it could rest. And if they really understood the Sabbath law, then they wouldn't have a problem with Jesus bringing rest and relief to a disabled man by healing his hand. The Pharisees were trying to portray Jesus as a Sabbath breaker, but that wasn't true. As Peter Lighthart says, Jesus never broke a Sabbath or made exceptions. Jesus keeps Sabbath by giving relief to the distressed. Now, you may be wondering why I'm talking about some story in the Gospel of Matthew when this is supposed to be a study of Deuteronomy. But I begin with Jesus and the Pharisees for a reason. Because when we come to Deuteronomy chapter 15, we encounter a series of laws that expand and that further apply the fundamental principles at the heart of the fourth commandment. Deuteronomy 15 helps us understand what the principle of Sabbath keeping looks like in practice. And it does so by focusing specifically on the duty that we as God's people have to bring rest and relief to the lives of the poor. Now you could tell that Moses' teaching here is related to the Sabbath command by how he begins. "At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release." Now, this isn't the first time that a law about release has drawn upon the Sabbath principle. In Exodus chapter 23, Moses had instructed the people that every 7 years they were to release their lands from work by not planting anything and by allowing their fields to lie fallow. Later in Leviticus chapter 25, Moses repeats these instructions about a Sabbath year for the fields, and then he goes on to add a rather shocking law about what to do with property. It's called the Year of Jubilee. Every 50 years, which means every year after seven cycles of 7 years, all property that has been purchased is to be returned to those who originally inherited it. If someone fell on hard times financially and they were forced to sell their family's property, it was okay to buy it from them. But every 50 years, all the land that had been purchased had to be given back. That's the law in Leviticus. And in Deuteronomy 15, we find something similar. Moses says that every 7 years, the people must grant a release. But this time, the release isn't about land, it's about debt. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. The Sri Lankan theologian, Ajit Fernando, he describes this commandment as an exceedingly unusual law, which I think, if anything, is a bit of an understatement. This law is practically unparalleled, because if followed, it means that all debts between Israelites must be forgiven every 7 years. If you loan somebody money, and if they've only paid off a fraction of that loan, you have no choice but to release them of the rest. Furthermore, if you continue reading to verse 12, you'll notice that debts are not the only thing which must be released every seventh year. If your brother, Moses says, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. Thus, God doesn't just command that all debts be forgiven every 7 years. He also commands that all slaves be released. What's more, and what's perhaps even more shocking, is the statement that Moses makes in verse 4. There shall be no poor among you. Now, this seems to be not only an empirical falsehood, because from everything that we know, there continued to be poor among the nation of Israel. It also seems like just some impossible utopian ideal. Is Moses actually suggesting that as long as Israel follows this law, that they'll be able to achieve a genuine total eradication of poverty? That prosperity will be universal and that poverty will become a thing of the past? Well, in a sense, yes. But as he continues, Moses also makes it clear that he doesn't actually expect this ideal to become a reality. For what does he say in verse 11? For there will never cease to be poor in the land. Now, how do we explain these seemingly contradictory statements? The Old Testament scholar Christopher Wright says that what Moses is doing here is he's setting up an intentional and an inherent tension. On the one hand, he says verses 4 through 6 portray an ideal situation, and Israel so rejoicing in God's blessing that they fully obey God's laws, and thereby enjoy further blessing in a mutually reinforcing cycle of gift and response. In such a context, there need be no poverty. That's the ideal, at least. But that's not actually what happened. As the prophet Jeremiah testified centuries later, speaking on behalf of God, I myself made a covenant with your fathers when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, saying, at the end of 7 years, each of you must set free the fellow Hebrew who has been sold to you and has served 6 years. You must set him free from your service. But your fathers did not listen to me or incline their ears to me. Apparently, Israel did not obey these laws. Maybe they found them just too impractical. Maybe they thought that following such laws would really fatally undermine their economic system. Maybe they were just greedy. For one reason or another, they didn't obey. And Moses already anticipates that they won't obey, which is why he doesn't just assume that they'll actually eradicate poverty. He assumes that the poor will remain. And given their ongoing presence, he then gives the people instructions for what to do. If among you one of your brothers should become poor, and any of your towns within the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Did you notice the way that Moses describes the poor? He doesn't just say, help the poor, as if they're some category of people in need. No, he specifically describes them as family, as your brother, which would include both men and women in Israel. Do not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, he says. And that's intentional. For as one commentator observes, those with whom one lives, as brother and sister, always have a proper claim upon one's compassion and care. Where that term, brother and sister or neighbor, is applicable, then enmity, disdain, negligence, and disregard are out of order. Several years ago, a social scientist named Robert Putnam published a book about the widening gap between the rich and poor in America. And he called the book Our Kids. And in the introduction, he explains that the reason he chose that title is because he's trying to point out that something significant has changed in America. Nowadays, rich people and poor people have little interaction with each other. And because of that, the poor are no longer people to whom we feel any sense of belonging. Now they're just a faceless category of people in need. But that wasn't always the case. Back in the 1950s, when Putnam was young, he says that American townsfolk often spoke and acted as if they somehow belonged to one another. A majority of the town would often attend the local high school graduation because, family or not, the townspeople thought of all the graduates as our kids. And Moses is doing something similar in the way that he's describing those in need. That's not just a poor person, he's saying. That is your brother, your neighbor, your poor. And he also gives a warning to the Israelites. Take care, he says, lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart. And you say, well, the seventh year, the year of release is near, and your eye look grudgingly, or more literally, and your eye be evil toward your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. It isn't enough to provide your poor brother with what he needs. You have to do it freely. You have to do it with a generous spirit. And to summarize all this, as Moses says in verse 11, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land. As usual, however, Moses doesn't just give commands. He also gives a reason for why we must be so generous and open-handed toward our neighbors. As he says in verse 15, you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. There's a reason you must give Sabbath rest to your neighbors. There's a reason you must alleviate their burdens. And it's because the same has been done for you. You too were once a slave. You too were oppressed. You too had nothing. But I, God is saying, I gave you rest. I gave you freedom. And I gave you land and work and homes and resources. So you go and do the same. I'm going to be honest. Of all the laws in Deuteronomy, I find these laws in chapter 15 to be some of the most convicting. Not because I'm a creditor, refusing to forgive a bunch of debts that are owed to me, but because I recognize that God is asking me to be far more generous and far more open-handed with my resources than I am. And maybe you feel the same as you're reading this chapter. In which case, what should we do? Speaking for myself, I think that one of the best things I could do would be to follow the advice that John Calvin gives in a sermon that he preached on this passage. Now let us kneel down in God's presence with acknowledgement of our faults, praying to Him to make us perceive them better and to touch us to the quick, to the end that knowing what His will toward us is, we may be moved thereby to follow the same by imparting ourselves in such ways to our neighbors and by disposing the goods which He has put into our hands. What should we do in the face of such laws? We should begin by asking for forgiveness and then pray that God would help us understand His will and be generous with the goods that He has put into our hands. I can't think of much better advice than that.